This is Jazz Talk, presented by Melbourne International Jazz Festival. We would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future, as well to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the wider Melbourne community and beyond. We are honoured to contribute to over 60,000 years of music making, knowledge sharing and storytelling that has taken place on this land. I'm Chelsea Wilson, Artistic Associate of Melbourne International Jazz Festival. This conversation, Perspectives on Jazz Piano, was a discussion between four Australian pianists at Melbourne Recital Centre as part of Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress 2021. Artists include Fulbright scholar, vocalist, pianist and songwriter Monique DiMatteo, broadcaster and pianist Adam Rudiger, pianist and composer Luke Howard, and the ARIA-winning composer and jazz musician Barney McCall, revealing their techniques, inspirations and creative journeys. Expect storytelling, live performance and camaraderie, perfect for aspiring pianists, accomplished artists and anyone who loves jazz and piano. This is Perspectives on Jazz Piano.
My name is Adam Rudiger, and it is my pleasure, privilege and honour to be moderating this panel today. We have joining us from St. Michael's Grammar School, my alma mater, Luke Howard.
Hi.
Got Monique DiMatteo and Barney McCall. And we are going to be talking all sorts of piano jazz related stuff, and we're going to be doing a few little performances too to kind of demonstrate in a practical sense some of the concepts that we're talking about and some of our philosophies, I would say, our musical philosophies. We're going to try and demonstrate them because we don't just want to talk about music for an hour, we want to, show you. So, I'm going to throw to Monique, and Monique, can you tell us just a little bit about how you came to piano and how you came to jazz?
So I started off in the kind of classical way, playing classical piano and playing a lot of different instruments when I was a high school kid, but I did have jazz piano lessons when I was 13 with Bob Settergreen. He taught me what a C7 was. He wrote it all down. He didn't write the... It was really cute because I was already like playing pretty heavy classical piano, but he wrote down the names like C, E, G, B flat, and wrote all of the dominant seven chord like schemas down in letter names, and I've still got that piece of paper.
Do you know I have a piece of paper that Steve Settergreen wrote me all the A and B voicings, and he said, learn these and come back to me in 3 months.
Yeah, so then, but I did classical for, like, I didn't get to jazz till I was about 20 actually. I did classical piano and then I studied other stuff, and then I thought, oh, it'd be nice to do some jazz. And I auditioned for the VCA, but I couldn't improvise at all. And I got in because I played transcriptions of Monk, and but I was playing note for note. And, you know, it was excruciating because I was the only kid in the course that didn't know how to improvise.
And here you are.
Nah.
So you mentioned Monk, so was that someone who was really significant in kind of getting you into that, like making you curious to want to explore it?
Yeah, there have been so many. Keith Jarrett was a big one. At that time, I was all about Chick Corea, Bill Evans, Keith Jarrett. But then as I went through my 20s and went through my journey, I sort of went back in time and got more into like Jelly Roll Morton, Fats Waller, early jazz became a kind of... Like that stuck more for me than the place that I entered it through.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you have you have an album, Nola's Ark, very New Orleans influenced, and those pianists you mentioned are sort of on the other end of the spectrum from loose, boozy, kind of raucous, you know, old style jazz. So yeah, that's interesting. I kind of started with the New Orleans aspect, I guess, because my mum really liked Harry Connick Jr. and all the big band stuff. But at that time, Harry Connick was going into a more of a New Orleans funk realm, and I loved that. And mum wasn't on board for that journey. Did you have a think about performing maybe a tune that is you know, was significant to you, that you would like to just give us an idea of your flavour?
Sure. I mean, okay, here we go. So I reckon I'll play some Fats Waller in that case.
Amazing.
I'm a low rider. Oh, it's going down. Great. Okay. So this is called Smash in Thirds. And this is actually what I do for fun at home. Things are busy. But this is like my time out recreation, is I just keep learning Fats Waller songs.
That's some fistfuls of keys right there.
Yeah.
Is that playing in that style, is that something that you gravitated towards naturally, like with your classical chops, or was that something you sort of really had to work to acquire?
I just loved the sound of it, actually. Yeah, no, I mean, it was sort of, I guess, with the classical background, it wasn't, it was an impediment to being able to get across stuff like that, but I had a kind of musical breakdown, I would say, in my 20s, where I'd been trying to get across all this kind of jazz pianism, and it really wasn't working for me. And I didn't like the way I sounded, but I just kept going, and it was kind of getting me down. And then I found Jelly Roll Morton, Fats Waller, James P. Johnson. There's just something in there that unlocked things for me. That and writing songs. Those, I think, were sort of the two keys for me that got me into just loving the music and feeling good about it.
Mm, brilliant. Thank you. Mr. Luke Howard, can I throw to you, and can you give us some insight into your background in piano and how you arrived in a jazz kind of realm?
Pretty similar to Monique's, really. Learned classical piano as a kid, but I guess never really... I guess I was always the person that made stuff up, or well, I became maybe a bit of a sort of trained monkey kind of thing, or untrained monkey. But, you know, I learned classical stuff, but I was always interested in improvising, and maybe it was just something that actually... Well, that's the thing. I suppose it came... It can come naturally to you, but classical music education often just squashes it out of you. But I managed to fight against that a bit, thanks to having some open-minded teachers. And then, yeah, I guess, you know, I was kind of interested in jazz, but I have no idea what it was. And, you know, it was like maybe my parents had one Dave Brubeck record. Feels like that's not an uncommon kind of thing, but I certainly didn't know who Bill Evans or Bud Powell or Keith Jarrett were. I mean, every now and then the door would open just a crack and I might maybe someone would lend me a like the Cologne concert or something, but I was never I never assimilated enough information to put together the puzzle of how all these artists related historically. And only when I went to VCA and kind of was like, all right, let's do this. And I mean, I thought I was a good improviser, but I was terrible. I mean, it took me many years after VCA to even learn how to play tastefully, but you know, I knew nothing when I started university. But then I went and I just became obsessed for a few years.
So
practiced.
What I'm getting from this is that VCA just will let in anybody as long as they can.
Oh, they probably, there was a bit of that at that time, but I think I was like, all right, I'm going here just as a framework to have a discipline framework so that I'll practice, and I'm not really going to pay too much attention to what everyone else is doing, because there were a lot of people that had different, maybe wanted diplomatically, wanted different things out of it, and or just had different artistic goals. And I was like, all right, because I'm a first principles guy, I want to know how stuff works. So like, all right, let's transcribe some Bud Powell, and you know, I want to go as far. I mean, I didn't go perhaps as far back as you did, but I wanted to know what the nuts and bolts were. I guess I was always interested in finding the people that had influenced the people that I liked, that I was aesthetically attracted to, rather than just trying to kind of copy the people I liked, because then you get like a second generation, you know, like copy.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's so interesting. I've definitely found that in my musical pursuits, always trying to understand sort of the family tree, the history, the evolution, and you can see what parts have been sort of cherry-picked and reinvented in a way. Yeah.
But I haven't really played. That's why I was a bit nervous when you mentioned that there was some playing involved today. I haven't played jazz like anything that swings or has 2-5-1s or, you know, I haven't really played that stuff for 10 years. And I was saying to Chelsea before, it's a bit like a language, like you might... Even if it's your mother tongue, which it isn't, but you can forget it if you don't use it, or you can certainly be very rusty, or at least need to be like tipsy in order to execute it.
But would you say maybe you're more influenced now by musics from other parts of the world, or at least places where jazz has evolved in a bit of a different direction?
I think like, I probably just went full Europe, you know?
Yeah. That's, like
that's maybe that's something thought. Culturally I identify with more too, but... But that's a whole other discussion. But
and what sort of appealed to you about that different flavour?
Well, I feel like early on I realised that maybe I didn't have an innate affinity with jazz. I just liked improvising, and I'd kind of learn about jazz because I had. I went to VCA, and my teachers encouraged that. And of course, it's hard not to love Keith Jarrett. But when I was left to my own devices for a few years after that, in the wilderness, I think I kind of reverted to my straight eighths, you know, no seventh chord roots. Well, that's where my heart is. And so eventually I became more confident in making the kind of music I wanted to make. I think maybe it's just my personality, but I feel like a lot of jazz... I mean, it was great to have an education, but and it's a very useful education, but I feel that maybe I went a bit too far into it simply... in order to please my teachers or to like, because I, you know, I felt I should be doing stuff and felt like maybe making music that was too simple was I might get in trouble or something. And then eventually I forgot about that. It took a good 10 or 15 years after BCA.
Interesting. Have you got something that you'd like to play for us, just that you feel exemplifies your personality on the piano a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, look, I have to admit that I did just I'm basically sight reading something, which is probably not what you asked for, but you did ask me this morning, and I thought about what kind of music is, what connects the jazz world and the kind of more compositional world that I inhabit, and play a Lyle Mays tune, which I don't know super well, but I feel like it does, it kind of brings those worlds together a bit. And he's a pianist that I always loved, but also someone that, someone who could play all of the jazz things, but obviously had a very different voice, but fits in that uncomfortable place where you ask a real heavy jazz person about them, and they're like, oh, that's smooth music,
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned before you're like a nuts and bolts kind of, you want to understand sort of the DNA of the tunes.
Yeah.
When you play something like that, are you sort of like seeing the chord progression roll by in your mind, and the notes are just sort of a particular voicings and particular ways of playing those chords, or are you just sort of like thinking of it just collections of notes at various points in time?
That's a great question. The answer often depends on how well you know the tune, and in that case, whilst Phil Lyle's playing was a real bridge between the jazz and compositional world, it's not a tune I know like the back of my hand. So the better you know it, the more you're able to kind of sail over the top. I felt for a long time I was really obsessed with trying to not get stuck in the chords, or particularly playing choruses of tunes, not wanting to have an overarching idea of things. But, trying to think about that stuff consciously while you're doing a gig is almost even worse than not thinking about it. I felt like I got better at structuring ideas over longer periods of time just by playing and recording and listening back and, those kind of things. So, yeah, I'm kind of thinking about, where it's going and the line, and the chords kind of coming along for the ride. Mm. But you've got to know the tune to really do that. And I picked a bad example in that respect. I was kind of like busking. Or it was very, and that's a weird tune. It's a great example, but it's an unusual tune too, because so much of it is just completely notated, and yet there's sort of little bits for improvising. It's not necessarily going to be that different every time you play it.
Yeah.
Or it's going to be different in different dimensions. It's going to be like dynamics, and that's the thing. I feel like with jazz, we get so obsessed with like the note choices in a way, because that's such an easy thing to teach. It's like, here are some chords, and by the way, there were some crazy ledger lines in that, and I had to write the actual notes like Bob Settegreen on it this morning, because I could not read like six ledger lines. But you get so obsessed with note choice, and perhaps that's because it's a very discreet thing to kind of teach, but as I've eliminated a lot of the note choices out of my playing by choice, then I've been forced to like think about other things like texture and dynamics. Whatever, all the other aspects of music you have. And whilst it may not be as complicated or maybe intellectually arresting as jazz, it's just as equally interesting. You can pick any element to go deep with.
Yeah, that's a great way of thinking about it, I think.
And I think, like, sometimes when you're so upset, obviously a great musician will be across all of these axes, and like incredible note choice, incredible use of space, dynamics, which is, the first thing an audience that's not a trained listener is going to respond to, like a sudden drop in dynamics or something that surprise, because surprise is such an important element. Those kind of things will like grab you way more than playing like the coolest, major third over a minor chord or something will. But it's great if you have all of those.
Ironically, can I just say something about that?
Yes, absolutely.
It's interesting, all the different ways of thinking about how to manifest music, but as I get older, I'm starting to think that, it's not my show, it's the music's show.
Yeah.
And what does the actual music want, as opposed to any any choices. There's no choices at a certain point. You know what I mean? Like, I love that was absolutely gorgeous, so beautiful. I really loved a copy of that score.
Playing in front of you guys.
It was so beautiful. But I'm just sort of thinking, you know, what does the music want to be? And I think that's, you know, and it's funny to, you know, because the way you play and it feels so flowing and it feels like you're just letting it be, but it seems that you're also considering a lot of angles that you naturally have.
I guess that's sort of that thing about composition and improvisation too, like the music can really, or the tune can really lead you on a path and exclude others. Like if you play a Meltdown tune, you kind of start to sound a bit like him because the harmony in it just leads you to those kind of choices. I mean, standards, I suppose, are probably the biggest open book because they've been around for a long time and people have done them in so many ways. But to play like Philip Glass or a minimalist version of like, you know, a tune that's full of 2-5-1s, it might be an interesting exercise, but it would probably sound a bit out of context. So I think the composition, the music can really does lead you to certain choices, maybe they're not choices.
I'm trying to let it. You know, I try to let it, but I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Barney, you've broken the ice now. So my question, my opener for you is, how is it that you and your brother ended up both being piano players? Was it a musical thing in your family? Or
It stems back from two things, sing-alongs. So we used to have sing-alongs at our house. My mum used to play, and then Jane Bernard, who was Len Bernard's wife, they lived. Len Bernard is a fantastic drummer, brother of Bob Bernard, and also both those guys. I mean, Len played in Galapiga Stuck. So I was very fortunate to be living in Moorabbark, and John too, and Len Bernard gave us all these records. So we were listening, being immersed in that beautiful Black American music, and then the sing-along. So I suppose both of us were sort of watching Mum play, and we've got this wooden box that's creating so much joy, you know? And I'm like, wow, what is that? I want to learn to do that. And I remember one of John's girlfriends, Jocelyn Morehouse, came over, and she was kind of a bit well-to-do and a bit cultured. And she came in and played a Mozart piece, and I could not freaking believe that Mozart was in the house. You know what I mean? So that it came from that. And also John was really pivotal. He was kind of hip, and he still is, to things that are moving. He's always looking for the future. And he turned me on to what jazz was. He taught... Well, I had this trio with these identical twins, the Tailby twins. And we were playing Bachman Turner Overdrive and all this stuff. And he came and he said, hey, Greg, the drummer, he said, play this beat this on the drums. Tom, go to bed. Tom, go to bed, Tom. He actually introduced us to what jazz is. And from that moment, like he, you know, and then he played me Bud Powell. So it was really having a piano, and I think everyone here should get a piano if you don't have one, because every piano should have a house in it. And, you know, the old world beauty of a piano, how great is it? So it was just having one, and then I would also say, you know, I think like Monique and Luke, like secretly we realized we needed to have it to exist on this wonderful planet of ours.
One thing, I mean, I heard quite a lot of Australian jazz growing up because my mum was a jazz lover and just played music around the house. And it's funny, reflecting back, I didn't make a distinction between world famous American jazz musicians and Kate Sobrano and Vince Jones, and you know, that was just music that I heard around the house, you know, and I learned a lot of standards, a lot of Duke Ellington and that kind of thing, just from those songs, just being exposed to them. So what were some of the early things that like really caught your ear that you gravitated towards?
Well, I suppose before I say that, I really need to recognize that, you know, the music that I love is a Black American music, and so much music stems from Africa on some levels. It was funny, I said to a friend of mine in New York, Josh Roseman, I said to him, what's happened to, like in the middle of lockdown, I was like, what happened to all those trumpet players who play all the high notes and they know all the bebop heads and everyone claps and that's their life, you know, like what are they doing if that's what their meaning is? And Josh's answer blew my mind. He said, well, you know, the African diaspora will reinvent itself again. we'll keep reinventing ourselves, you know. And I'm thinking, wow, how beautiful is that, you know? So I need to point that out. But in answer to your question, Pinetop Smith was the first record
right,
I ever heard.
Old school, like Monique.
Yeah, and he was like, he speaks on the record, he's like, there's a lot of people out there making a hell of a lot of money playing this air music. I better start practicing right now. And then he plays all this stuff. And I mean, it was amazing that I'm 7 years old getting to hear this incredible, you know, Muddy Waters. And then a Bud Powell record on Metro, which had Hallucinations, Willow Grove. And I specifically remember John playing me Willow Grove because someone at some gig, he was already gigging, he's a bit older than me, and someone had said, check out Bud, do your head a favor. And he's like, who's Bud? Bud Powell, you know. And he bought this record back and he said, hey, Reg, he calls me Reg. He said, Reg, check this out. And he put on the blues. And the blues, I'll just play a little bit of the blues. It goes like this. And I was like, what the hell? And I could remember just how blown away I was by that very moment. I was like, I don't know what this is, but it's some mystical, ritualistic freak show, and I want to know how to do it. And I was like, man, if I could just play one of those Oscar Peterson lines, like one of those weaving lines, I would be the happiest person in the world, you know. And I did learn it, and then it just keeps, you know.
I learned an Oscar Peterson piano solo when I didn't know who Oscar Peterson was.
Oh, my God.
I had a MIDI file on my computer.
That's very modern.
Of Take the A-Train, and because I could, you know, in MIDI, it's on your computer, you can break it down and see all the notes and slow it down. And I just learned this solo note for note just because I really loved the sound of it. And I was playing all these voicings, had no idea what the chords were, I just learned the shapes. And that eventually led to me, I was a film student and I was making a documentary video for Steve Sedergreen and his band Mistaken Identity. And someone told Steve that I was a piano player. And I was like, I know that. And he got up to have a jam, and the only tune I knew was Take the A-Train, but I only knew this Oscar Peterson version. And I kind of crashed and burned on the notes of the solo halfway through, but I knew enough with my ear to be able to play the shapes that fit. And then I, you know, started studying with Steve, like, shortly after that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's
cool. A beautiful thing.
It's cool how your ear just falls in love with these sounds.
Yeah, just singing along with records and just loving it, because I remember just listening and singing along with someone. I could sing whole solos. I could sing all the solos off Miles Davis' tune-up. But what I was actually doing was learning how to phrase and learning this language, you know.
Have you got something you'd like to play for us?
Yeah, after hearing these guys, I have changed my mind what I should play. I'm going to play a piece I wrote called Nectar Spur, which is, I see it as like, it's all my stuff all together. So it's what I arrived at, but thank you.
From Pine Top, hang on, was it Pine Top?
Pine Top Smith.
Pine Top Smith. It was like Pine Top Perkins, Pine Top Smith. There are several Pine Tops. From Pine Top to that, that's quite a long journey. Mm. There's a lot in
well,
there.
I mean, that's kind of why I wanted to play it, because it is a kind of a distillation, crystallization of what I became, in a way, you know. And, you know, when I was about 19, I found myself at this Egberto Gismonti concert with Nano Vasconcellos, these incredible Brazilian virtuosos. And that concert itself just changed my whole DNA, and that song on some level comes from that, so Villa-Lobos and the European composers that were sort of transmuted through them or like distilled through them. But how do we arrive at who we are, really? I mean, you know, we play improvised music. We're sort of, it's almost like we're creeping towards who we are if we do these improvisations, but maybe all of our improvisations come together to be who we are. So I suppose what I'm saying is I'm trying to work out what I hear and make that.
Mm. An incredible diversity of material that the three of you picked. We haven't had a standard yet. We haven't really, I mean, you know, it's kind of swung your one, Monique, but a lot of the traditional concepts of what, and I'm not going to get into the conversation, what is jazz, but I just want to say that you know, obviously that it's evolved so much and incorporates so many different influences that all this can be considered part of the same, you know, universe. It's a shared universe. That's what the kids are into these days, with the Avengers, you know, and, you know, Batman and Superman, they're part of the same world. I'm going to play a tune. We haven't done a standard, so I'm going to do a standard. And I like daggy old tunes that you can sort of play a little bit differently and a little bit hipper. And I remember back in about the year 2000 when Dizzy's opened on Swan Street, Richmond, they had a jam session there, and this is really where I cut my teeth and learned to play. And a singer who will remain nameless said to me, "Oh, what should I sing?" And I was just really into this tune at the time. I said, "Why don't you sing Sweet Georgia Brown?" She said, "Don't tell me what to sing." Thank you. Cool. So, you know, mucking around, really. I have a student and we have this saying, we go, music is stupid. Because he goes, but it's so simple. He goes, this idea is so, oh, why do I always complicate things? And I go, I know, music's stupid. But, you know, like from a certain perspective, that's complicated what I just did. But it's not complicated to me because I'm just seeing it as a very simple kind of framework.
Well, know? There's joy.
Yeah, I love that tune. You know, like it's not, some people would be like, oh, that's like Harlem Globetrotters. That's like a stupid, infantile, you know.
Well, I wouldn't piece. Use those words, but I feel like, you know, like how do you just play stuff you love and work out and just use that as your springboard, which is, you know, the way you're playing that, there's real joy in it, and that is, you get that from it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. Barney McCall, he liked mine. Just you were here. Cool. So Barney, one of the things that we discussed when we were sort of figuring out a framework for this is you wanted to talk about music as healing.
Mm.
So what's your ideas on that?
Oh, I suppose it's just that, you know, especially for students and people upcoming or anyone who's trying to work on something and wondering why they do it, I love the idea that that we do this because it heals us. That's why we practice and that's why we play the music. And then it potentially heals people who listen. It is a spiritual practice. Music is a spiritual practice. And as Bill Evans says, you know, it shows you parts of yourself that you didn't know existed. How amazing is that? You know, and all sorts of music, not just jazz, but, you know, I just watched the Beatles documentary. And I, you know, everyone's saying, "Oh, it's too long." It was only, you know, it was 8 hours. I'm like, it's only 8 hours. I could listen, I could watch and feel those guys making music for so long because you're gleaning all these things from their responses. But you know, that's healing music to me. However you slice it, you know, I'm listening to Rolling Stones in the car, and you know, and I listen to all sorts of things. But I just feel like it's a really important aspect of music that sometimes is forgotten by especially people coming up trying to learn this music, especially in these harrowing times that we're living in. And it's just a beautiful thought. And what do you feel about that?
Yeah, like it's not something I think about too consciously, but obviously it exists on a subconscious level. Like I know it feels good when I go play the piano. You know, I very rarely sit down to practice, but I, you know, I'm always curious to learn new repertoire. I have a voracious appetite for new tunes, new ideas. I do a lot of arranging and sort of a lot of writing. Yeah. And, you know, I think that that's a motivation underneath it. It feels good inherently. And yeah. So it is a distraction from anxieties and pressures and especially, you know, in recent times, like in lockdown, I was really productive. I was like, oh my God, I have headspace to work on stuff, you know. And it was really, really good. I didn't do any practice, but I did things that, you know, that I wanted to do. I downloaded new sort of synth plugins, and I do a lot of, you know, synthesizer electronic stuff as you do too. I really had a good time. You know, Monique, what is that a kind of motivating factor for you, or why do you feel that you have this desire to pursue this life when you could be working in a cubicle making lots of money?
Yeah, I really relate to what Barney's saying, and I've been reading the Helen Garner Diaries, and there was a line yesterday. She said something like she would. I feel like she wrote this when she was in her 50s, just inching towards something that I don't understand, but it's the answer to everything. And I feel like that. I don't understand the choices I made 20 years ago that made me get here, but I think healing is the word. You know, if we cut ourselves, our body gets going healing that. Mm. And our motivations are the same. We don't always understand them. You know, my mum got down on her knees and begged me to go back and study law. You know, I don't know. I just had this, and it wasn't working out for me for a long time, this obsession I had with finding the sound I wanted to make on the piano. But it makes more sense to me now. And I think of someone like Gil Askey, you know, he went out blasting at the age of 87, playing that trumpet all night long and giving so much joy to so many, including me. And I feel like I'm getting closer. And and I say this to students a lot, time spent on your instrument and on your music is never time lost, because you're working on yourself, you're working on your spiritual journey.
I tried to say that one time when I was in year 12, and Mum said, get off the piano and go, you know, do your homework and do your study. I'm like, Mum, no, I'm working hard at something.
Yeah, yeah. It's the path. It's the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Luke, what's your perspective on this?
Yeah, I agree with both Monique and Barney. I mean, sometimes I think it's self-indulgent to be an artist, but it also, well, you know, it's also a career in some degree, but yeah, music has the power to heal yourself and also other people, and that's sort of a nice bonus, I guess. I mean, I feel like I'm always looking. I mean, the thing I struggle with is sometimes the potency of music to really move me is lost a bit, because I've been so overexposed to it. Like the first time I heard a major 7 sharp 11 chord at VCA or something, I was like, my God, what is this beautiful, like,
I taught that chord to a kid yesterday
that I've never heard. Yeah. And then you can get desensitized. So every time I find that moment where music moves me the way it did the first time, I'm always trying to hang in someone else's music more often than my own, but I'm trying to capture that. And also, it's not just about being moved. Having fun is also, joy is a really big part of it as well. You know, there's also, look, there's a practical dimension of surviving as an artist and doing all those things as well. It's probably not as purely as, but there'd be a practical dimension being a monk as well. Like you've got to eat somehow.
Yeah.
I was saying I taught a major 7 sharp 11 chord to a student yesterday, and I got to experience, like, for the first time hearing it through his eyes. You know, that's something that I find really rewarding with teaching is, yeah, you know, you get to reveal these truths or these insanely cool things about the mechanics of music and see people go, oh my God, you mean that when dominant 7 chords go around the cycle, the 3rd and the 7 descend chromatically? You know, the intellectual part of it doesn't really matter, but the sound of it, and they're like, you know, and they're kind of learning to make themselves happy.
I mean, I think for a musician there's a sense of discovery, which is really exciting, but for the punter that may not be a musician, of course the music affects them in different ways, and you know, maybe our own music does or maybe it doesn't. I feel like the moment for me, and again it's not like a popularity contest, but when my own music started to connect with my friends rather than feeling like I had to drag them to my gigs, because I actually wanted to come and see it, so that was a real moment of feeling that I was sharing something and not just kind of, you know, navel-gazing or just all practiced up. I mean, I used to have, like, a lot of technique and nothing to say or no gigs of interest or no original ideas. And now, well, I mean, I may not have that many original ideas and I certainly don't have as much technique, but I feel like I can connect a bit more, and I feel that's a big part of the spiritual side. It's not just a solitary endeavour.
Excellent. Well, we're running short on time. We've got to wrap it up really soon. I would love to open up the floor for maybe just one or two questions from the audience. Has anybody got anything that they'd like to ask? Hello. Hey, Jay.
That chord that you were just discussing, could one of the panels just play their own interpretation of that chord?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, that's one way of doing it. But it's this sound. Major 7 sharp 11.
Major 7 sharp 11.
Yeah.
We all agree with that.
I think it's like, how can something, understanding those chords is like understanding how ugliness can be beautiful, because it's, you know, it's dissonant. And if you play some of the intervals, it'll sound, even in 2021, it'll sound a little bit narky, but understanding those, it's like food, you know, you've got to like something, you may not like it, you've got to understand you have to be exposed to it, and then you start to love it, and
you get to love your bit of greens.
Yeah, and then eventually you want to like play all of the notes and find them and down the bottom of the piano. I mean, maybe I don't want to do
But I also loved like Joni Mitchell's take on it, which is that they're not chords, they're just feelings.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, these even jazz musicians say to her, "What's that weird chord you're playing?" And she's like, "It's just a feeling." And I remember Mulgrew Miller also saying that. Like, I was like, "Oh man, can you just show me what that chord is? I can show you the chord."
Yeah.
But it's a feeling, and you'll understand that later. And so, you know, chords came after the feeling.
Yeah.
You know, chords came. Chords are just beautiful melody notes. You know, they're actually just a combination of melody notes. But yeah, I mean.
But particularly with people like Joni, I feel like her music's kind of so personal. It's almost untranscribable. Mm. It's like a kind of. You know, it's like you're trying to chase, if you try and write it out, also it's all to do with the way she phrases, but if you try to write it out, you'll never get there. It's like, it's the piece that cannot be written down, whereas, you know, other music.
It's not in the notes.
Yeah.
It's not just in the notes.
Definitely not just in the notes, yeah.
But did you have a question about that chord, or?
Just wanted to hear it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you feel like the heavens were opening when you heard that?
All right, let's take one. Thanks, Jay. Let's take one more question before we wrap up. Anybody got something?
I've got one.
Yeah?
You mentioned Oscar Peterson earlier on, the influence of Oscar Peterson and that on you. I'd say Oscar Peterson is the early modern jazz era. I have the privilege, I've been a jazz listener, for over 60-odd years now. I had the privilege of seeing the Oscar at the Melbourne Town Hall in 1962 with the original trio of Ray Brown on bass and Egg Thibkin on drums, which was sensational. And it put me on my journey for the last 60-odd years as being a great jazz pianist follower. And also I want to make a comment to Barney. I've got Barney's Mural Bar CD, which I absolutely love. Hector's Bar is fantastic, and also Coast Road.
I don't know if we have time, but thank you very much. I mean, I could play a little bit, but
my favourite tune off that is Apple Tree. That's kills
I
me.
I could that play one. That, but yeah. It's, I mean, actually, I was just talking to Mark Fitzgibbon, the fantastic one of my favourite piano players, Mark Fitzgibbon. He was at that concert too. Yeah, I think he went with his dad.
Wow.
And I mean, Oscar Peterson. He's coming from the Art Tatum tradition, but yeah, you're exactly right. Like he bought all these beautiful colours, and I always say to my students, it's like, if you want to know the chords to a song, Oscar has them. He always has the best voicings, but I always go to Oscar to find out what the chords are. You know,
beautiful. But on that point, we're saying it's the feeling, it's not the notes. I heard him at the Blue Note after his stroke. You know, he had a stroke. Mm. And he mostly lost his left hand pretty much, but he was still gigging and he'd slowed down a lot. This was in, this must have been like the early 2000s. And so, you know, half the notes were not there that used to be there, but oh my God, the feeling was all there. It was so great.
Yeah, number of notes does not matter to the feeling.
Yeah, no.
All right, well. Thank you very much for your attention, everyone. Please thank Luke Howard, Monique DiMatina, Barney McCall, and
Adam Rudiger.
I'd like to say a very big thank you to the Jazz Festival, the Melbourne International Jazz Festival, for having us. It's been an absolutely wonderful experience, and there are still more concerts over the weekend, so hopefully you're getting out and seeing some things. So thank you very much.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, everyone.
That was Perspectives on Jazz Piano, recorded at Melbourne Recital Centre as part of Melbourne International Jazz Festival Congress 2021. Please keep in touch with Melbourne International Jazz Festival by subscribing to our e-news at melbournejazz.com. Follow us on social media and subscribe on your preferred platform for more podcast episodes. We would like to thank Principal Partners Creative Victoria and the Australia Council, the Vizard Foundation, the Rise Fund, an Australian Government Initiative, the Helen McPherson Smith Trust, and the US Consulate.